I'm Dr. Rod Berger. Sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and explore some of today's most pressing educational issues through the experienced eyes of leading education personalities. Welcome to Coffeed. Well, John, it's nice to sit down with you again, and obviously you're drinking tea. I've got my coffee here.
We may have to switch to iced tea with this lovely spring here.
I know, you're right. You know, John, we haven't talked a lot about the research, and I saw, I'd really be curious to your thoughts, but I saw where there was a study that looked at autism intervention and that the studies in autism intervention lack diversity. And this came out of the University of Kansas. And I was just curious, what's your initial take on that, you know, sort of hypothesis? And are we really lacking in diversity in the research?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that needs to be addressed or at least thought about right now in schools and in medicine as well. There are a couple of lines of thought that immediately come to mind, Rod, and one of them is the cultural sensitivity related to autism and behavior that would be autistic behavior, I guess, or autism behavior may be the better word. There are some things that we think about in our culture that are part and parcel. We like a firm handshake and a steady gaze into the eye, and people who are unable to do that, we think, oh, there may be something wrong. Do they have autism? Are they shy? What's the issue? But other cultures don't especially encourage that direct eye-to-eye contact, and part of that is even the Native American culture here is not as strongly promoting that eye-to-eye look, steady gaze that we hold so highly in our kind of Anglo or at least Western culture right now. So there are some aspects that's one that comes to mind right away. Another is the way in which people culturally describe behaviors. I know sometimes you would have somebody that would say, I am depressed in our culture because something bad has happened or a tragedy is affecting someone's moods and emotions. Yet people from other parts of the Western world don't use the word depressed in that manner. They may say that their nerves hurt. That's an expression that I'm familiar with from people in Eastern Europe. And the end result is that there are kind of cultural differences in how we perceive illnesses and how we perceive behaviors that make diagnosing children with autism tricky in this country. We're very sensitive to it. Our awareness as school districts and as physicians is heightened right now with all the media and the dramatic increase in the numbers of children with autism and the expansion of the definition of autism under the DSM-5 now that's been out 18 months or so. Yet it's still culturally tough. It could be very tough to diagnose non-Western children with the disease in terms of our frame.
What's the impact then on the intervention side of it then, John? I mean, if we're struggling to, because I hear what you're saying, it's that if we're having trouble to identify with the families in front of us based on different cultural backgrounds, then you would think that then there's going to be a challenge on the intervention side of it as well. And maybe potentially, is there a delay? I mean, if we're having trouble gathering the information we need as clinicians to make a diagnosis, and maybe we're not getting the right information because of the way we're asking it, does that then impact intervention?
Yeah, I'd say that definitely is going to impact intervention. The Pediatric Society came out with a piece just a little earlier this year it was last year it came out, and it was by medical researchers out of the University of Pittsburgh, and they were looking at the rise of disabilities, and one of the things that they looked at, one of the conclusions that they drew, was that there indeed has been a increase in the number of kids diagnosed with a neurodevelopmental disability, which is not exactly autism, but autism is a neurodevelopmental disability. There are others besides autism. So it wasn't specifically looking at autism. But the researchers concluded that without being on autism specifically, but this was a reflection of the rise of children being diagnosed with autism. The same study said this, which I find interesting and related to our conversation this afternoon, is what they found is the rise is in families that are substantially above the poverty line, meaning that the wealthier families are those contributing to the rise of diagnosis of kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities, for example, autism. What that means is that poorer families are not being diagnosed at the same rate. It doesn't mean they don't have the disease at the same rate. And the lack of diagnosis is a very, very big cultural factor. And it goes hand in glove with the fact that more people of color are in lower socioeconomic ranks in America than not. And so that's one of the reasons I think we have a disproportionate number of kids, of white kids, being diagnosed with autism. It's not that African-American or Latino-American children don't have it. It's that they're not diagnosed as much. And part of that, again, is I was in a really interesting conversation last month with the head of an executive director of one of the major autism advocacy groups here, and he says he's not surprised by that because, look, even though the federal government said in the summer of 2014, now we're going on not quite 20 months since President Obama made the proclamation that Medicaid must cover services for children with autism. That's a big deal. That covers
very big deal.
Millions and millions of children. But the reality is, okay, yes, the law says to cover it, but the system doesn't have a lot of neurodevelopmental pediatricians sitting in poverty zones ready to diagnose these kids. And those that head of the executive association of that advocacy group says, well, the reality is it hasn't moved the needle because there aren't appropriate people in poverty don't have access to the people to diagnose their child, to help them. And those few people that do take Medicaid that may be able to diagnose children are, 6 months to 18 months on a waiting list. And every day is critical for a young child with autism. Every day, every week, every month that passes, it's harder for that child to recover, to elevate the trajectory of their life. So it's a real problem, Rod, this kind of lack of diagnosis.
Lack of diagnosis, and then looking at the interventions and, as I was looking at this article in Science Codex about the study at University of Kansas, they had one of the co-authors, he said in here, Jason Travers, assistant professor of special education at the University of Kansas, he said, quote, "I think teachers and researchers can tend to categorize these methods of interventions with the label evidence-based practices and assume that they will be effective and that when that's not always the case."
Yeah, I think, I hear that, Rod, and I know this could really go into a discussion that could take us all afternoon about school districts and the response on that. What evidence-based practice means is it's pretty soft sometimes, and it doesn't mean best practice. And
don't people interpret it that way? It's almost like reading a label and they say it's the best or it's the, whatever product you're buying. So don't you think the general public sees evidence-based and they think it is best practice?
I think you're correct that, just because it's evidence-based doesn't mean it's best. Evidence-based could also mean the results aren't good.
Right.
Evidence, it just means it has been examined, it's been researched, it's been looking at through perhaps with a strong empirical design. But still, one of the things we know right now, Rod, that I'm absolutely certain on is the advances that we are making in neurodevelopmental science are rapid and current, yet they are not getting to the typical public school special education classroom. They are, they're rapid, you know, advances in neurodevelopmental pediatrics and neurology are great. I mean, they're really going to advantage children as that work gets into the training of teachers. But that lag time between what we know and what we practice is significant now. And teacher training programs are way behind the curve in terms of teaching the very best practice or the very best evidence-based practice or using the very best science out of neuropediatrics or neurodevelopmental studies. We're way behind it. So that's another reason that I think families get, you know, don't look to the schools in order to give them, in order to give the best treatment for their children. They go to pediatricians or other types of scientists whose field is moving much faster than special education.
Yeah, and you know, that's a point I want to touch on the next time we have coffee or tea, John, is I want to talk about, you know, I saw a story about in the UK where they're talking about training all teachers in the area of autism and spectrum disorders. And so we'll hold that for the next time we get together, but that was a really good point you just made. I want to touch back on that the next time we chat.
Let's make sure we do, because there are just a handful of things I think if we would include in teacher training for all teachers, K-12 teachers in the country, we would be far, far ahead of what we can do for kids now. So let's pick that up in our next conversation.
Sounds good, John. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Roz. Always a pleasure.
Join us for our next cup of coffee as we continue to have conversations in education that matter to you. I'm Dr. Rod Berger, and this is Coffee.